Welcome to Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine Podcast. Today, I'd like to draw your attention to an emerging trend that is quietly reshaping pediatric health. It's the rising prevalence of myopia, or short-sightedness, in children and adolescents. Myopia is being diagnosed at an alarming rate, and it's affecting not just children's vision, but their overall quality of life. Understanding the drivers behind this growing epidemic and the long-term implications is crucial for healthcare providers to be able to offer timely advice and interventions for parents and young people. Our expert guest today is going to lead us in a discussion exploring exactly how we can play a pivotal role in preserving the visual health of the next generation.
I'm Katrina Brown, Clinical Content Manager at Springer Medicine. I'm thrilled that Dr. Angrit Dalman-Noor is able to join us today to discuss the growing prevalence of myopia in children and what we can do to slow it down. Dr. Dalman-Noor is a consultant ophthalmologist focusing on children and young people at the NIHR Moorfields Biomedical Research Centre in London. She's a highly active researcher leading several clinical trials of treatments for myopia and amblyopia. So, Dr. Dalman-Noor, can we start by taking a look at the growing prevalence? How many children are currently affected by myopia, and how do you expect that number to change in future?
Thank you very much for inviting me to record this podcast today on a topic that I feel very passionate about, short-sightedness or myopia in children. In the UK, to answer your question about the how many children are currently affected, in the UK we don't have the exact numbers because we have not had an epidemiological study that would have been representative of the whole of the UK population. However, we do have data from the NICER study in Northern Ireland, which was published back in 2016. And that study indicated that around 10% of children aged 10 to 12 years had myopia, and that the number increases with age, so that by age 15 to 16 years, about 25% of teenagers had myopia. Now, you have to bear in mind that the Northern Irish population in that study was mostly of white ethnicity. So another important question is, what does the situation look like in other parts of the UK, in urban areas, in areas with a high proportion of global majority populations? And so far, we only have small studies that have addressed that question. There has been a study in Birmingham reported in 2010, 2011, looking at ethnic variations. And they observed that children from South Asian families had a nearly 9 times higher risk of developing myopia than white children, and those from black families had a 3 to 4 times higher risk than white children. So overall, if we take those figures as baseline, then, and we know that there are about 8 million young people in the UK in the age bracket 10 to 19 years, we can safely assume that in the UK, more than 1 million children and young people have myopia today. The other figures that we can look at are those from Europe. There have been Europe-wide studies, and what we have seen is that prevalence really varies. So different local studies have shown that depending on the setting and depending on the type of population, there were fluctuations in numbers, but overall the trend seems to be increasing. So we're fairly confident to say that over the past 25 years, the numbers have been going up everywhere in Europe, that today over 30% of young adults have myopia, and that the trend is rising. Now, it's still not as prevalent in the West as it is in East Asian countries, for example. In Taiwan and Singapore, more than 80% of 18-year-olds have myopia. And globally, it is very much a public health concern these days. And it's estimated that already a third of children and young people have myopia worldwide, and that by 2050, more than 740 million children and young people will have myopia.
Goodness, it just shows what a huge problem it's become. Global rates of myopia were rising markedly across the first two decades of the 2000s. They jumped from 25% in the first decade to 30% in the second decade, and most recently, between 2020 and 2023, reached 36%. What do you think has been driving this increase?
Well, we think that the main driver of this increase in myopia prevalence is changes in lifestyle. So there is urbanization that happened over that period of time, people moving more into large urban centers for work. That then causes difficulties sometimes with access to green space. So children have less opportunities to go outdoors and be in nature. Hence, finding a park or playground near where you live might be very useful and important. And on a more personal level, there is also the educational drive and the educational pressure that has increased a lot. So in many countries, children now spend long days at school and spend increasing amounts of time on near vision activities. So on the one side, they spend less time outdoors. On the other, they spend more times indoors and on studying activities. And to top it all, they might still have to do schoolwork or tutoring activities even after school. And it is thought that these two factors, so time outdoors, exposure to sunlight and near work, are important. And of course, they now have access, many children have access to electronic devices, be they tablet computers or smartphones, to stay in touch with their social networks and their friends.
What impact do you think screens are having?
Well, it is not only the screens, really. It is the working distance, what you're looking at. So we know that the rise in myopia prevalence precedes very clearly the introduction of smartphones, but it more coincides with increasing educational pressure on children. So children tend to spend a lot of time on near work, reading books and also using screens at school. And now they also use screens to stay in touch with their friends after school and in the evenings, as well as for their homework. So during all these activities, they have to look at something close up. And these prolonged near vision activities over long periods of time, they have been linked to myopia as well. And it may be no coincidence that the countries that have the highest rates of childhood and adolescence myopia also have the highest level of educational pressure, with children attending school during the day and having additional tutoring in the evening. And it has to be said that initiatives in these countries to build more outdoor time into the school day, into after school activities, and also the family weekend activities have started to show a really good effect and impact on slowing down the onset of myopia.
So there's been a lot of discussion about the effect of the COVID pandemic on children and adolescents and a whole variety of health aspects. What impact do you think the COVID pandemic had on eyesight?
Again, the levels of evidence that we have varies a little bit, but the core message is very strong. There is strong evidence from different countries all over the world that the COVID lockdowns caused an increase in myopia, particularly in young children. So during the lockdowns, children couldn't go outside, or at least not as much as they used to. And education in most settings changed to online classrooms and a lot of home study with bookwork. In China, for example, where they're doing refraction tests, that's the eye test for glasses, every year at school using objective devices to measure how short-sighted or normal-sighted children are, they found that the rate of myopia in six-year-olds jumped from about 5.7% pre-COVID to 21.5% in 2020. So that's about a 4 times increase during the COVID period. And this is mainly due to the lockdowns. And over here, anecdotally, optometrists and parents tell me quite frequently that they have seen a shift in myopia, that there has been more progression during COVID and after COVID, and that more younger children these days attend and are found to have myopia.
Sure. So circling back then to overall causes, how much influence do you think genetics has?
Well, genetics does have an impact, but it doesn't explain this really strong increase in prevalence. Genetics would mean that we somehow adapt to something, and it doesn't work this fast. So the genetic predisposition, like in the sense of evolution, doesn't change this rapidly. But we do know that the risk of developing myopia is higher for those children who have one parent who has myopia, and even higher for those where both parents have myopia. And we also know that ethnic differences play at least a part in myopia risk, and there is then an inherent genetic susceptibility there as well. But bear in mind that we do not only inherit our parents' genes, we also inherit their lifestyle. So whilst genetic risk factors do play a part, lifestyle changes, so urbanization, more time indoors, are more likely to explain the rapid increase of myopia at a population level.
So then thinking about what we can do, what interventions can help to reduce the incidence of myopia or slow its progression once the first signs appear?
So starting with reducing the incidence, so the main effect that we can hope to achieve is to delay the onset. So that would reduce the incidence in the younger age groups, if you want. So how could we delay the onset? And one useful approach is to ask children and young people to spend at least an hour and a half to 2 hours a day outside. There is really strong evidence that more time outdoors delays the onset of myopia. And because of the data that we already talked about from the COVID lockdowns, we know that time outdoors also has an effect on slowing the worsening of myopia. And the other important preventative or early intervention approach is that children should wear the correct glasses. We know that if you wear the correct prescription that gives you perfect distance vision and keep your glasses up to date, that also has an effect on myopia progression.
So you've mentioned glasses. I'm conscious as well that contact lenses and atropine are also already available as treatments. How do those help slow myopia progression and how effective are they at doing so?
So there is a difference between the sort of traditional glasses and these new solutions that have been developed to slow down progression. So what I mentioned before with wearing the correct glasses, those are the traditional glasses that correct your distance vision, right? So they give you clear vision, they are easily available from all optometrists, and they give you good distance vision. They do not have a very strong effect on slowing down myopia. For that, there are now more effective treatments that come as glasses or contact lenses, and now lately also pharmaceutical interventions. So the way that the special glasses and contact lenses actually work, most of them create an area of blurring the back of the eye. So they create a second image shell in front of the retina, and that is thought to counteract further eye growth. And the central part in these lenses still brings the central part of the visual field into perfect focus. And it is only the mid-peripheral vision that is slightly blurred. And because we mostly rely on your central vision to do visual tasks, children tend to adapt very quickly to these lenses. And the atropine eye drops that you mentioned, so that's another option. It's a pharmacological option using low concentration atropine eye drops once a day at bedtime. And about the mechanism of action, atropine seems to have several mechanisms of action. And the most important ones, probably in the context of myopia progression, are that it modifies the cellular signaling in the retina, which is involved in eye growth. And it also increases the blood flow at the back of the eye in the choroid. The choroid is a layer rich in blood vessels, which supplies the outer retina and also the sclera, the white shell of the eye. So it brings nutrients and oxygen to the outer retina and to the sclera. And that is important in myopia because it is the sclera that undergoes remodeling and becomes thinner and thereby allows the eye to become longer. So in myopia, the problem is that most of the time is that the eyes grow a little bit too long. They grow longer than they should be. And in order for that to happen, the sclera, the tough white outer coat of the eye, must remodel and become thinner. So it is thought that a lack of oxygen in the sclera promotes that process. And because the atropine, low concentration atropine, increases the blood flow in the choroid, there is less hypoxia in the sclera, and that might be one mechanism how atropine slows down that process. What we don't know yet about atropine is the optimum concentration. So atropine is a medication that has got slight side effects only on the eye. It slightly dilates the pupils. That means children can initially be more sensitive to light, and it can also blur their near vision very slightly. And because of that, people are very cautious about finding the optimum concentration that we should use. In East Asia, where the research has been running into this topic for over 20 years. There was one study, the LAMP trial, that has shown that 0.05% atropine is well tolerated and also has a stronger effect than lower concentrations of atropine. And that has then prompted clinical trials all over the world, including in Australia, Europe, and North America. But there we have tested mainly the very low concentrations, so 0.01 and 0.02% to start with. And we've seen that there is a small beneficial effect, but not as large as the one reported for 0.05% in the LAMP trial. And because of that gap in the evidence for our Western populations, another trial is just in setup at the moment, the Moderato trial, which will use and test 0.05% in children across Europe. And we hope that that trial will then fill the gap in the evidence that we have at the moment.
How does the age of the child impact the effectiveness of the intervention?
So basically, the rate of eye growth is fastest in the pre-teenager years. So between, let's say, the ages of 5 to 12, 13 years is the fastest rate of eye elongation, where there is a risk that the target of 24 millimeters eye length can be overshot. So obviously, you're born with very small eyes, 16 to 18 millimeters. In adults, it used to be the final length of the eye used to be 24 millimeters. And there is an exponential growth in infancy and early childhood. But it is in the clinics, in the clinical setting where we are discussing myopia, we are mostly concerned about the young children who develop myopia at a very young age. So let's say age 5 to 6, because they have got many years of growing up to do. And they are in this phase where the elongation of the eye is very rapid. So you will see with all these interventions that the effect depends on the underlying growth rate of the eye. So in a very young child, it might seem that progression is still fast, although they are using these optical or pharmacological approaches. But actually, overall, when you relate it to the underlying natural growth rate of the eye, all these interventions do slow down the eye elongation by about 40 to 50% looking across the several trials. And then it seems that the effect slows down as they get older, but that is probably linked to the fact that the natural eye growth rate is also slowing down. So the biggest impact really is before the age of 13 in terms of slowing down elongation of the eye and reducing the final degree of myopia.
So you've covered for us about spectacles and contact lenses and atropine. Are there other developments, treatment developments that you can tell us about?
Yes. So other approaches are, for example, in the field of using devices that emit certain wavelengths of light, because it has been found that that also has a beneficial effect. The first one there was long wavelength light, so that is in the red spectrum, because that improves blood flow. We know that from all the devices that are used for well-being and dermatology, so skin conditions. And in myopia, the long wavelength light, the red light, improves again the blood flow in the choroid. So it's a little bit like the atropine story. There is better perfusion, more oxygen going to the sclera with this approach. And the first method that got to the level of getting marketing authorization was low-level red laser treatment. But unfortunately, there were then some case reports of children's retina suffering harm from the laser, and that has limited the widespread implementation of this approach. But the discussion around that is still ongoing. And at my institution, we are currently working on understanding better what the red light actually does and the levels of red light that are needed to achieve the desired effect that we are after, and also how best to monitor children to make sure that we do not see any adverse effects or that we detect any changes early before it comes to the level of harm. Our study is the red light myopia study, and we have a study website if your listeners are interested, redlightmyopia.com. And there is also another light-based approach that is on its way, let's say, to clinical practice, and that is using the opposite end of the light spectrum in terms of wavelengths. And this involves shining a blue light at the optic nerve head. So we know that in the optic nerve head, the cells are bundled that are responsible for retinal signaling pathways, and shining a blue light is thought to release dopamine, just as sunlight hitting the retina would do. And this approach has by now gone through very extensive preclinical work. And the results of a recent phase 2 clinical trial have been presented last year at the International Myopia Conference. And because initial results have been promising, future work is planned about the blue light as well.
Excellent, thank you. So moving on then, myopia is linked to sight-threatening complications such as myopic macular degeneration, retinal detachment, cataracts, glaucoma, which can lead to increased healthcare expenses. Should we as healthcare providers be worried?
Yes, I do think so. And the rate of change has been faster than I had expected, because the prevalence of myopia and high myopia is not as dramatic in the UK and in Western countries as it is in East Asia. However, the rates of, for example, surgical repairs for retinal detachments have increased in England and Scotland even over the past 10 years, and specifically in people of working age. That has been shown in national audits, both in England and in Scotland. Now, they couldn't say whether there was a link to myopia because the audits didn't collect information about people's refractive errors, so the glasses prescription. And looking at our own patient statistics at Moorfields, we then found that myopia indeed seems to be driving this trend. So in our patient population, 25% of those who needed retinal detachment repair in 2016 had myopia, but in 2023, so just 7 years later, the percentage had increased from 25 to 40%. So 40% of people who came for retinal detachment repair had myopia. And when we then looked further into the age brackets, we found that it was particularly in working age and younger people that this trend was at play. So for example, in the under 60s, 60% of patients who needed retinal detachment repair also had myopia. So it seems really that there is an increase in complication rates for retinal detachments because of the rise of myopia. With the other complications, it's a little bit more difficult to track the exact numbers. For example, for myopic macular degeneration, the hospital coding systems often don't have that particular diagnosis, or not all clinicians would select that particular diagnosis. But we do know that more people now need injection treatments for myopic macular degeneration, and that they tend to receive this treatment at a far younger age than those receiving the same treatment for age-related macular degeneration. And that is a concern because it really hits people of working age who are still providing for their families, who need to hold down jobs, and who find themselves severely impaired by not being able to see properly. And it is also a concern because there is no cure for macular degeneration. For example, the age-related form is now the leading cause of sight impairment and blindness in the UK. And the form that is linked to myopia and starts earlier, we know is linked to the degree of myopia that you have as an adult. So after your eyes have stopped growing, your level of myopia tends to remain fairly stable. And we know that every additional diopter of final degree of myopia increases the risk of suffering myopic macular degeneration by 67%. And that makes it so important in my mind that we try to limit the progression of myopia in children and in young people. Because if you turn that calculation round, then a reduction of the final degree of myopia by one diopter reduces the risk of myopic macular degeneration by 40%. And with these new interventions that we now have, reducing the final degree by a diopter and possibly even two diopters is achievable. So yes, I think it is a very important topic, particularly if you factor in the long-term complications. And the last one of the big three complications linked with myopia is damage to the delicate optic nerve fibers that take the visual information from the eye to the brain. At the point where they leave the eye, they take a nearly 90-degree turn. And at that point, they are very vulnerable to pressure. So many people who have high pressure in the eye, that's called glaucoma, suffer visual field damage because the optic nerve fibers suffer and get damaged there. But that also happens in myopia, and even when the pressure inside the eye is normal. And the mechanism is that the back part of the eye around the optic nerve head becomes very unstable and the fibers get stretched and they get a bit rattled. And that seems to be causing the damage to the optic nerve fibers. And again, in the UK, because we don't have myopia as such a important topic on our agenda at the moment, it's difficult to get accurate numbers and prevalence figures. But in countries such as Japan, it is very, very well documented that myopia, and particularly high degrees of myopia, are now causing visual field loss in many middle-aged and older people.
It's just fascinating to understand the long-term health impacts that myopia in childhood can have. We're always told that prevention is better than cure. And considering the environmental contributors that you've mentioned, there are clearly preventive measures that could be taken to reduce the incidence of myopia. What do you think the priorities should be for the future?
Well, I always think that all adults are somewhat responsible for the children around them, and that if we all cluster around our children collectively, then we can make a difference. And because myopia starts in childhood, if all adults around the child work together, then I think we can reduce the risk of myopia and complications in the future. That might mean that parents and nurseries and schools and other educators need to work together to get children outdoors for an hour and a half to 2 hours a day, and to limit the near vision work when they are inside. And that is for the younger children. There are also school movements such as the forest schools or Teach Outdoors, which use experiences outside the classroom as much as possible. For parents, easy wins can be the way to school and back. So walking, cycling, going on the scooter where possible, and maybe stopping at a park or at a playground on the way home. As they get older, you could sign them up for outdoor team sports or any other activities that take place outside, because then they are also embedded into a community of like-minded kids, which is a lot more fun for them. And then as they get older, it becomes a bit more tricky to have an impact and influence. But we do know that it would be good that they should spend less time on near vision activities. So there we would again look at the educators to develop alternative teaching methods other than just books and using reading and writing as a medium. The vexed question of the smartphones, I think it's not the only factor. So it wouldn't be the game changer to lock up all the smartphones. And of course, that would be wildly unpopular with young people. But I believe that teenagers, young people are very smart. And if we give them the right information, then they will be able to make sensible choices for themselves and for their future health. For example, some teenagers have a screen time monitoring app running in the background on their phones and use that to remind themselves that, you know, they have been on the device for a long time and maybe it would be time for a break. So there are lots of things that young people can set up for themselves to monitor what they are doing. So really, I think that to stem the tide of myopia, we all need to work together. And that includes the children and the young people, as well as the parents, educators, eye care professionals, and also the policy and funding decision makers. And in my mind, just raising awareness via a podcast like this one is a very important first step. So we have worked also with stakeholders like kids and parents and eye care professionals to put myopia on everyone's agenda. And that work needs to continue and is always ongoing. For example, we could think of doing campaigns in the media and at local level, in schools, in GP surgeries, in optometry practices. We could involve youth clubs. So I think it's important that everybody feels that they have ownership of what we are trying to achieve, which is to get the kids outside more and limit the use of technology.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Dalmanur. I've thoroughly enjoyed our discussion today. I really hope our listeners will have a much better understanding of the scale of the problem and what they can do to help tackle it. Thank you.
This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist.
and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.